Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now going to cover Ezekiel chapter 20, verses 32 through 49, the second part of the chapter. I will entitle this section, The Lord Will Restore Israel. Now, in the first part of the chapter, we have a lot of hellfire and damnation called down upon Jerusalem. We're going to get a little bit more of that here at the end of chapter 20, but then we're going to see there's going to be some restoration, some grace in the midst of the judgment. The timing of this last section of Ezekiel 20 is in the seventh year of the exile of Ezekiel to Babylon. He was exiled in 597. The seventh year is 590. We'll go a year to the left and the right. So let's say 591 to 589 is approximately when this chapter was written. And of course, the Babylonian siege of Jerusalem started in 588 and finished in 586 with the destruction of Jerusalem. Chapter 20 is 1 year later than chapters 8 through 19, which were given between 592 and 590. So that's where we are. So we begin now in Ezekiel 20, verses 32 through 34. You say, we pick up in the middle of Yahweh speaking through Ezekiel to the Jews. You say, we want to be like the nations, like the peoples of the world, who serve wood and stone. But what you have in mind will never happen. As surely as I live, declares the sovereign Lord, I will rule over you with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm and with outpoured wrath. I will bring you from the nations and gather you from the countries where you have been scattered with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm and with outpoured wrath. Now we'll talk about who these people are that want to be idolaters and who are going to be judged with wrath in just a minute. In verse 33, we see that God is speaking with an oath. As surely as I live, God swears by himself because there's nobody higher than he can swear by. As surely as I live, declares the sovereign Lord. The Lord always refers to himself as the sovereign Lord all the way through the book of Ezekiel. That means God can judge the way he wants to. He can forgive the way he wants to. He can bring nations into this place or that place the way he wants to. And he can stop Israel from worshiping idols, is what he's talking about here. He says that it will never happen that you're going to serve wood and stone. God says in verse 33, I will rule over you with a mighty hand. And as John Gill says, that's not in a gentle and merciful way, but with great rigor and severity. Though they had contrived to withdraw themselves from under his domination and government by joining with the Gentiles. So God is going to stop the idolatry. He's not going to destroy them. He's going to restore them. But he is going to stop the idolatry with a whole lot of judgment. Outpoured wrath. Verse 34, God says, I will bring you from the nations and gather you from the countries. Now this gathering from the countries and from the nations at first makes one to think of the return from Babylon to Jerusalem by the exiles in circa 538 or 537 BC or so under the edict of Cyrus the Great, the Persian who had beaten the Babylonians and set the Jews free from the Babylonians. But that's not so easy here, so I'm going to give you some options as to what this gathering is. Well, as I said, it sounds like the return from Babylon, but both Ellicott and Kyle and Delitzsch deny that. I think they're right, because if we drop down to verse 38, we read, although I will bring them out of the land where they are living, yet they will not enter the land of Israel. Well, the return of the exiles, of course, that involved Jews returning to the land of Israel in order to rebuild the temple and so forth. So I'm going to knock that option out. Option number two, this is from the pulpit commentary. This is referring to a future return which hasn't happened yet. That's the punt option. We don't know what this refers to in history, so we'll just put it off into the far future where nobody can affirm it or deny it. I don't like those options. Colin Delitzsch denies explicitly that that's true. So we'll throw out option number two. Now, option number three is, this is referring to an influx of believers into Jesus' kingdom. Problem with that is, this influx is all associated with wrath. Verse 33, I will rule over you with an outstretched arm and with outpoured wrath, and then I will bring you from the nations. That doesn't sound like Jesus bringing in the sheaves, in my humble opinion. So we go to option number four. This is from Ellicott. This gathering, according to Ellicott, refers to Yahweh's dealings with the people in their dispersion among the nations. As John Gill says, the Jews had dispersed for safety as they saw the Babylonians getting ready to come, and so they headed out to other nations like Edom, Moab, Syria, And when they got there, they wanted to adopt the idols of their new country. Now, why would Yahweh be dealing with the Jews and their dispersion among the nations? And that would be either before the exile in 586 or even afterwards. It doesn't make any difference. The point is that the Jews are everywhere now. They're not in the land of Israel, and they are tempted to become idolaters. So now why does God have to deal with them in wrath before they return in 538 to 537 to Jerusalem? Because he's got to purge them of their idolatry. They've got to make the spiritual cut, in other words, in order to get back to Jerusalem to build that new temple. Now, I think this is the correct option here. Let me read you from what Ellicott says. This cannot refer to the restoration of the people to their land, both because it is an avenging act with fury or wrath poured out, and also because its object is said in the next verse to be to bring them into the wilderness. So the gathering here is not the return, which is going to come later, but the gathering is before that return to Jerusalem, a gathering into the wilderness so God can do some purging. As Poole says, God will bring them into Babylonish captivity. Well, Poole thinks that the gathering is gathering them into Babylon rather than into Israel. We'll talk about different options as to where they were gathered to. The point is here, though, in general, these commentators are saying this gathering is for judgment, wrath on the people of the Jews who later will come into the return to Jerusalem, 538-537 B.C. Let's read Kyle and Delitzsch. According to the context, this leading out is an act of divine anger, which Israel is to feel in connection therewith, and this cannot be affirmed of either the redemption of the people out of the captivity in Babylon, or it cannot refer to the future gathering of Israel from its dispersion. The future gathering of Israel from its dispersion was my option number B, which pulpit commentator held to a future return which hasn't happened yet. Colin Dillich denies that. He also denies that it's talking about, the gathering is talking about the redemption of the people out of captivity in Babylon as they're gathered into Israel. He denies that. All right, so this is a little bit complicated, but I believe that this gathering is a preliminary judgment of the scattered Jews, whether they were scattered before 586 or whether it was 597, 586. We go now to Ezekiel 20, verses 35 through 38. Yahweh continues, I will bring you into the desert of the nations, and there, face to face, I will execute judgment upon you. Well, right there, verse 35 tells us that this gathering does not refer to the gathering of the Jews back in the Holy Land. The gathering is into the desert of the nations. We'll talk about what that might be in just a minute. And there, in the desert of the nations, face to face, I will execute judgment upon you. As I judged your fathers in the desert of the land of Egypt, so I will judge you, declares the Sovereign Lord. I will take note of you as you pass under my rod, and I will bring you into the bond of the covenant. I will purge you of those who revolt and rebel against me. Although I will bring them out of the land where they are living, yet they will not enter the land of Israel. Then you will know that I am the Lord. So this gathering, in verse 35, is said to be into the desert of the nations. I've got six possible options as to what that desert of the nations might be. We'll start with option number one. This is suggested by Benson as an option. The desert of the nations, according to this option, is that the barren lands where Babylon had planted the exiles is the desert of the nations. The exiles in 597, also in 586 it could be. So this would be a literal interpretation of that phrase, desert of the nations. Moab, Edom, Ammon, Syria, all the lands that are to the east of Israel out into the Arabian desert. Option number two. This is an option that Benson considers. The pulpit commentator likes it. The Cambridge commentator likes it. The desert of the nations, according to option number two, is the Syro-Arabian desert between Babylon and Jerusalem. Some people call that desert the Syro-Babylonian desert. Basically, it's Syria and Babylon between the Euphrates River and Jerusalem, the Arabian desert there. And so God is taking the exiles into that desert, and he's going to purge them. And as we see in verse 36, this purging is to be like what happened to Israel on the Exodus at Mount Sinai. Verse 36 says, as I judged your fathers in the desert of the land of Egypt, so I will judge you. So likewise, I'm taking you out of Babylon now. We're getting ready for a new Exodus out of Babylon, back into the promised land, sort of a recapitulation of what has happened earlier in your history. And just like what happened before, I had to purge you. Remember, all those over 20 died in the wilderness. They didn't make it into the promised land. Likewise, God is going to purge those who are leaving Babylon so that the idolaters will not come back into the promised land. Well, option number one and option number two are literal options. Either the barren lands in general all over the ancient Near East, option one, or option two, that particular desert between Babylon and Jerusalem, the Arabian desert. Now let's look at some metaphorical options. Option number three, this is from Albert Barnes. The desert of the nations is a metaphor for all the nations where the Jews were dispersed during Jesus' time. So now we're jumping ahead, forgetting the history. I never like to do that. I don't mind doing it as an antitype, but to do that as a direct prophecy of the Old Testament prophet, I think, is not a good idea. That's just my opinion. So let's go to option number four. The desert of the nations is a metaphor for the low spiritual state of the Jews after their return to Judah. This is Calvin's suggestion. But the problem with that is verse 38 says they will not enter the land of Israel. And so how can Calvin say that this refers to the low spiritual state of the Jews after their return to Judah, if they're not going to return to Judah? I don't know how he handles that, but I don't like that option. So let's look at option number five. This is from Ellicott. The desert of the nations is a metaphor for the low spiritual state of the scattered Jews before their return to Judah. Now that makes more sense to me. They're in a desert, and they're scattered to the nations. Of course, the nations are all the constituent nations of the Babylonian Empire. And this would be before the return to Judah, because those who are subject to this gathering judgment, they're not going to enter into the promised land, as verse 38 says, so it fits. Let me read you what Ellicott says. This might refer, as some commentators think, to the state of the Jews in our own time, in other words, in the New Covenant era, dispersed among all nations, but there is nothing in the connection to indicate so distant a future. So that takes care of the future option. And it may quite as well refer to the then approaching condition of the people. Already many thousands of them had been carried captive to Babylon. Others had been scattered among all the surrounding nations. The mass of the 10 tribes had long before been carried by the king of Assyria to other regions. That was 722. And the large remnant still left in Judea, influenced by their own fears, soon afterwards went down to Egypt. So the Jews are scattered everywhere, all over the place. In Ezekiel's own lifetime, Israel was scattered widely among all the prominent nations of the earth, and thus brought into the wilderness of the people. And I think that summarizes it right there. So God's going to purge all the Jews that are scattered, so that only a small number of them will enter back into the Holy Land, 538-537 B.C., under Cyrus's decree. Now there's an option number six, and actually this is the one I prefer, is that this spiritual winnowing that's going to occur is a type of the spiritual winnowing that's going to occur in the New Testament when people are judged or convicted of their sin, I should say, by the Holy Spirit, and then the elect comes in. Not everybody, but the elect of the Gentiles come into the New Jerusalem, the church. Interpreting these Old Testament prophets always comes down to this. What is the prophet referring to in his own time or close to his own time? And how is that a type of the New Testament? And people split over that all the time. I prefer to take the both-and approach. The history is there, and that is a type of what's going to happen in the future. Now, in verse 35, God says he's going to gather the Jews into the desert of the nations, and there face to face he will execute judgment upon you. What does that phrase face to face mean? It means God is going to show his judgment very clearly on the Israelites. If you're talking to somebody face to face, you can see what they're saying. Now this phrase is taken from Deuteronomy 5:4, which says, the Lord spoke to you Israelites face to face from the fire on the mountain. Now, as I said, this wrath facing the Jews in the desert of the nations was similar to the wrath that the Jews felt from God in the desert of the land of Egypt. The desert of the nations in verse 35 is contrasted with the desert of the land of Egypt in verse 36. So there's a parallel there. Well, how did God judge the Jews in the land of Egypt, or in the desert of the land of Egypt, which is the desert on the way out of Egypt on into Israel? Well, John Gill cites a particular passage in the Old Testament to fulfill that, Numbers 14, 29 through 30, and I think he's right. Numbers 14, 29 through 30 says, "Your corpses will fall in this wilderness, all of you who were registered in the census, the entire number of you 20 years old or more, because you have complained about me. I swear that none of you will enter the land I promised to settle you in, except Caleb son of Jephunneh and Joshua son of Nun." So because the majority of the people believe the bad report of the spies, all the adults are going to die in the wilderness, 20 years old or more, and those under 20 get to go into the promised land. So they were judged. They were culled. They were winnowed. Likewise, the returning exiles coming from all over the ancient Near East, especially from the city of Babylon or the area around Babylon, they're going to be culled and winnowed too. There's not going to be any idolatry that's coming back into the land of Israel as the temple is going to be rebuilt. Verse 37, "I will take note of you as you pass under my rod." Well, what does the rod mean? Two options. First, the rod could refer to the rod of correction. God's correcting the Jews. Benson mentions that as an option. Another option is the rod refers to the tithing of sheep. Benson mentions that as an option, and Clark believes that this is the correct reference. Clark says, quote, "This alludes to the custom of tithing the sheep. I take it from the rabbis. The sheep were all penned, and the shepherd stood at the door of the fold, where only one sheep could come out at once. He had in his hand a rod dipped in vermilion," that's red, "and as they came out, the sheep came out, he counted 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and as the tenth came out, he marked it with the rod and said, 'This is the tenth,' and that was set apart for the Lord." So if that's the reference here, and I think it probably is, God's going to say, "I'm going to take a tithe, if you will, a portion of all the people who want to come back to Jerusalem, and I'm only going to let a tenth of them come in." Roughly speaking, metaphorically speaking, a portion only will be able to get in. Now you think about it, there's a lot of trouble coming back to Jerusalem. You have to pick up your business, your farm, your home, your family members. You got to travel across a desert. When you come back, you got to start all over again. You're facing unknown dangers. What about all the surrounding pagans, the Ammonites, the Moabites, and so forth? We read the book of Ezra and Nehemiah. The returnees had a lot of trouble with their pagan neighbors. So there was a lot of trouble getting back into Jerusalem, and so God probably used that trouble to cull the Jewish herd, if you will, so that only the righteous non-idolaters could come back into the Holy Land. Now at the end of verse 37, Yahweh says, "I will bring you into the bond of the covenant." I assume that's the old covenant they were already under, which was the Mosaic covenant. The bond there gives the idea of a shackle or a fetter. A bond means you're not getting out of this. You've got to obey. No more idolatry. Verse 38, "I will purge you of those who revolt and rebel against me." There's the purge. "Although I will bring them out of the land where they are living," and that is primarily Babylon. It could refer to anywhere in the ancient Near East, including even Egypt, if people had fled to Egypt. "God will bring them out, yet they will not enter the land of Israel." In other words, they're free to come back because they're pagan masters let them loose, mainly because of Cyrus the Great, the Persian. But that doesn't mean they're going to enter the land of Israel. They're going to be stopped. "Then you will know that I am the Lord." And so now we move to Ezekiel 20, verses 39 through 44. Yahweh continues, "As for you, O house of Israel, this is what the sovereign Lord says. Go and serve your idols, every one of you. But afterward, you will surely listen to me and no longer profane my holy name with your gifts and idols. For on my holy mountain, the high mountain of Israel, declares the sovereign Lord, there in the land the entire house of Israel will serve me, and there I will accept them. There I will require your offerings and your choice gifts, along with all your holy sacrifices. I will accept you as fragrant incense when I bring you out from the nations and gather you from the countries where you have been scattered. And I will show myself holy among you in the sight of the nations. Then you will know that I am the Lord when I bring you into the land of Israel, the land I had sworn with uplifted hand to give to your fathers. There you will remember your conduct and all the actions by which you have defiled yourselves, and you will loathe yourselves for all the evil you have done. You will know that I am the Lord when I deal with you for my name's sake and not according to your evil ways and your corrupt practices, O house of Israel, declares the sovereign Lord. Now in verse 39, Yahweh says, go and serve your idols. Well, obviously, I don't think that he's being serious there. I think he's using sarcasm. For example, go ahead and vote for that woke moron and enjoy what you get. Go ahead and serve your idols. But you're not coming into the promised land if you do that. Now, Jameson Fossen Brown has this take on it. He says, it's better to wholeheartedly serve idols than the halfway Jehovah idol worship they've got now. I don't think so. I think they're both wrong, but I don't think that Ezekiel or Yahweh is talking about half-hearted Jehovah idol worship. I think he's just being sarcastic. You're serving the idols of the Gentile nations into which you've been scattered? Well, you can go ahead and do it now, but afterwards you better listen to me. You're not going to do it anymore. You're going to listen to me. You're no longer going to profane my holy name. Because in verse 40, on my holy mountain, that's Mount Zion, which of course is the symbol, the metonymy, if you will, for Israel. For on my holy mountain, the high mountain of Israel, declares the sovereign Lord, you're going to serve me. So go ahead and serve your idols while you got a chance. But you're going to come back into Israel, you're going to serve me, Yahweh. And again, he doesn't want them to be serving the idols. It's just an expression, a sarcastic expression. So you're going to be serving me in there, in the land, on the mountain of Israel, Mount Zion. I will accept your gifts. I will require your offerings and your choice gifts, along with all your holy sacrifices. He's going to accept them, and he's going to require them too. Verse 41, I will accept you as fragrant incense. Of course, that's a reference to the temple ritual. They were constantly burning that holy incense that had to be made a certain way with certain spices, and they'd burn it on the golden altar of incense at the doorway of the Holy of Holies, the incense ascending continually to heaven as a symbol of the prayers of the saints. Well, now, the people are going to be that fragrant incense, constantly ascending up into heaven. So, things are looking up. This is going to happen when I bring you out from the nations and gather you from the countries where you have been scattered. And I will show myself holy among you in the sight of the nations. In other words, separate. That's what holy means, separated unto God. The people are separate from the idols. They're separate from the profane peoples around them. And they're going to be consecrated, separated from the evil people and consecrated unto God. Holy. Verse 42, then you will know that I am the Lord when I bring you into the land of Israel. Now there, at this point, we need to stop and say, when does this occur when God brings them into the land of Israel? When they do come in verse 42, they're going to know the Lord. And in verse 40, they're going to serve God. When does this occur? Well, here's some options. This is from Charles Ellicott and Matthew Poole. Option number one, during the work of the restoration of the temple, the restoration of Jerusalem, and the restoration of Judah. In other words, after the return. Ellicott says, it is not necessary to explain any of the expressions in this passage as looking for their direct and immediate fulfillment beyond the restoration under Zerubbabel. That would be the 538/537 return. That's when they're going to come back. That's easy enough, I think. But option number two, and this is from Gill and Clark, the serving of God and the returning unto God refers to the conversion of Jews into Christians, the conversion of Jews into the Christian church. Albert Barnes agrees with that. He says, this points to the consummation indicated by the vision of the temple. That's the vision at the end of the book of Ezekiel, the so-called millennial temple, which is really the prophecy of the church. This points to the consummation indicated by the vision of the temple. This points to times yet future when in Messiah's kingdom, Jews and Gentiles alike shall be gathered into one kingdom, the kingdom of Christ. Jerusalem is the church of Christ, into which the children of Israel shall at last be gathered, and so the prophecy shall be fulfilled. Well, the fact, as I said earlier, that Ezekiel's vision of the so-called millennial temple starting in chapter 48, and the millennium is between the first and second advent. I'm sorry, I'm not a pre-mill guy. That's referring to the church, and so if Ezekiel's talking about the church at the end of the book, it would lead one to think that maybe he's talking about the church right here at the beginning of the book, this serving and returning into the land. Well, we have two options here. Option number one, the physical return to Jerusalem and the rebuilding of the physical temple. Option number two, the return of Jews, the conversion of Jews into the new Jerusalem, the new temple, the Christian church. How about option number three? The restoration under Zerubbabel is a type of conversions into the Christian church. Here's what Ellicott says. Yet in view of the parallelism and connection between the two events, the physical return in 538/37 BC and the conversion of Jews and Gentiles in the New Testament, yet in view of the parallelism and connection between the two, we can hardly avoid the supposition that in predicting the restoration, the prophetic eye looked beyond to the greater glory of the Christian dispensation, of which that restoration was a type. That's the option I prefer. I like historical fulfillments as a type of spiritual fulfillments in the church. Well, when this return under Zerubbabel occurs, then in verse 42, the people will know that Yahweh is Yahweh, and that the land is the land which God had sworn with uplifted hand, that's how you swear, with an uplifted hand, to give to your fathers, Abraham, Genesis 15. People are going to know that that covenant's still in effect. I haven't forgotten my covenant. Verse 43, there you will remember your conduct by which you defiled yourselves, and you're going to hate yourselves. You're going to loathe yourselves for all the evil you've done, because they're repentant now. Verse 44, you will know that I'm the Lord, and you're going to know that I dealt with you not because of your good works, not according to your evil ways and your corrupt practices, but I dealt with you for my name's sake, because I want to uphold the honor of the name of Yahweh, because I made a covenant, and I want to keep that covenant. And so this is how God handles two contradictory things. How does he keep a covenant when he's dealing with such jerks, such idolatrous morons as the Jews? Well, he does it by purging the Jews. He does it with a remnant. He gathers the mass into the desert of the nations. I believe that's metaphorical. And then he purges the mass and comes up with the remnant and puts them back into the land. And now his covenant is still going. And yet at the same time, he's able to punish sin. We go now to Ezekiel 20, verses 45 through 49, and we will finish this audio. Ezekiel is speaking now, and he says, "The word of the Lord came to me." And now Yahweh speaks, "Son of man, set your face toward the south, preach against the south, and prophesy against the forest of the southland. Say to the southern forest, 'Hear the word of the Lord.' This is what the sovereign Lord says. I am about to set fire to you, and it will consume all your trees, both green and dry. The blazing flame will not be quenched, and every face from south to north will be scorched by it. Everyone will see that I, the Lord, have kindled it. It will not be quenched." Then I said, this is Ezekiel speaking now, then I said, "Ah, sovereign Lord, they are saying, Ah, sovereign Lord, they are saying of me, isn't he just telling parables?" And verse 46, Yahweh calls Ezekiel son of man. And as I've said many times, because that title, son of man, shows up in just about every chapter, there are two possible reasons why God calls Ezekiel son of man. Son of means having the characteristics of. And so Ezekiel has the characteristics of a man. A man is finite. He's weak. He has foibles. And so Yahweh is saying, "Ezekiel, you're just a man. You've had a lot of visions and prophecies from me, but don't get the big head because of it." Option number two, the reason that Yahweh calls Ezekiel son of man is because Yahweh is deliberately making Ezekiel a type of the son of man in the new covenant, i.e. Jesus. Jesus called himself the Son of Man constantly. Nobody else did, except one time I think Stephen in Acts did. And Jesus got the title from Daniel 7:14. The Son of Man came up to the Ancient of Days. And so that Son of Man was taken by all the Jews to be the Messiah. And so Jesus used the title Son of Man to show that he was the Messiah. Well, Ezekiel makes a great type of that, because Ezekiel is speaking to a rebellious house of Israel. And he's speaking about the destruction of the temple in 586. Jesus is speaking to the rebellious house of Israel, and he predicted the destruction of the temple in AD 70 on the Olivet Discourse. Not one stone will be left on another. And so Ezekiel makes a good type. And so God, knowing the beginning and the end, he says, "Okay, Ezekiel, we're going to make you a type of Jesus." I like that theory. So Ezekiel, you're supposed to set your face toward the south, against the forest of the southland. Now, what is the forest of the Southland? Let me give you two options. Option number one, is Jerusalem, as John Gill says, the city of Jerusalem in the land of Judea, which was very full of people, as a forest of trees. In other words, Judea had a whole bunch of people in it, just like a forest. So the forest, I should say more precisely, the city of Jerusalem has a lot of people in it as a forest of trees. I think that's what Gill means. Poole says it's Jerusalem. Jerusalem, which was become like a forest for multitude of inhabitants, for barrenness, wildness, degeneracy, and sheltering wild beast, murderers lodged in her. The other option as to what the forest of the Southland is Judea, and I think that's the correct option. Barnes believes that. Here's what he says. Chabar is in the north of Babylonia. From the north, the Chaldeans came upon Judea. Chabar is where Ezekiel is living in Babylon, the Chabar River. Ellicott says Judea is spoken of as, quote, the south, because although actually nearly west from Babylon, Judea could only be approached by the Babylonians from the north on account of the great intervening desert. Hence, the prophets always speak of the armies of Babylon as coming from the north. And I've pointed that out to you many, many times before. Matthew Poole says he, referring to Ezekiel, was now in Babylon, north from Jerusalem, and being commanded to look toward the south, it is toward Jerusalem and the land of Canaan. All right, so it's either Jerusalem or Judea. I think it's Judea. Prophesy against Judea, Ezekiel. Verse 47, say to the southern forest, and again we'll take the forest meaning all the people in Judea, hear the word of the Lord. This is what the sovereign Lord says. I'm about to set fire to you. And of course that happened in 586, quite literally, when the Babylonian troops torched Jerusalem and burned it to the ground. This fire will consume all your trees. And remember, the trees are the people. Both green and dry. A green tree is a young tree. Dry is an old tree. Both young people and old people. Of course, dry trees burn a lot better. So when you say the green tree is going to burn as well as the dry, that means the fire is very, very hot. Not only will this flame be very, very hot, it will also be very, very extensive. It will not be quenched. Every face from south to north will be scorched by it. From the south in Beersheba to the north at Dan. So this is metaphorical, of course. Jerusalem didn't have a physical flame that burned it, but now the blazing flame is burning the whole land up, and that didn't happen. But the whole land of Judah was basically wiped out. I said from Dan to Beersheba, that would include the northern tribes. The northern tribes are already gone. So this would be from the south of Judah and the Negev to the northern boundary of Judah, which is the northern boundary of the tribe of Benjamin. Verse 48, everyone will see that I, the Lord, have kindled it. It will not be quenched. Verse 49, then I, Ezekiel, said, ah, sovereign Lord, they are saying of me, isn't he just telling parables? Ezekiel is probably getting tired of not getting listened to. If you are a Christian and you have constantly exhorted people to love Jesus, believe in him, confess your sins, and then don't backslide, live a holy life, you will very, very quickly run into lots and lots of people who will not pay you any attention. So the people were not paying Ezekiel any attention at all. He's just telling parables. Yeah, he's telling parables, all right. And those parables are going to tell an interesting story when the fire of Babylon comes and burns Jerusalem to the ground. Maybe the people thought that Ezekiel's words were hard to understand. He's just telling stories, parables. What's his point? Well, I think his point was fairly easy to discern. It's not that hard to discern if you're living back then and you know what's going on. It might be a little bit harder for us because we don't know the history or the geography or anything else or the language. So modern-day readers of the prophets often feel confused. Also, maybe not because of spiritual hard-heartedness, but just because they don't know what's going on, they ask, why isn't this clearer? Well, lots and lots of study will make the prophecies a lot clearer, and a lot of people are not willing to spend the time to study the scriptures, especially the Old Testament prophets, to know what was going on. But a lot of the problems of the people poo-pooing Ezekiel and saying he is merely speaking parables is because they were sinful people who simply refused to hear the word of the Lord. And it's amazing how many people are like that. Well, ladies and gentlemen, God went from doom and gloom. He went to some judgment, and then, oh, goody, the return is going to happen, and good things are going to happen in Zion. And then he finished the chapter up. He goes back to the doom and gloom. The judgment is coming on the people. So we know where the emphasis is here. This is probably why so many people think the Old Testament is full of nothing but judgment. Because when you do see judgment in the Old Testament, it's quite graphic and pronounced. But there's lots and lots and lots of mercy in the Old Testament, too, that people tend to forget about. Even in this chapter, there was some mercy. The return to Jerusalem. And people will again offer gifts to Yahweh on God's holy mountain, Mount Zion. So, ladies and gentlemen, we finish now Ezekiel 20, and we are prepared to go to Ezekiel 21, which I will entitle, The Lord Has Drawn His Sword. More judgment. Hope you stay tuned for that, and I hope you enjoyed this audio.